Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible by The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta offers a private dining room for parties, meetings, and other events. The Great Impasta, 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. I suspect from time to time just about everyone feels anxious. You might feel a bit tense, or you might feel panic, physically ill, your heart racing. It can be serious enough to leave you frightened and exhausted. The stresses and strains of everyday life can cause us anxiety, making a presentation at work, standing in line, getting dinner on the table, traffic. Then there are times when we're confronted with events and circumstances and feelings that can really overwhelm us. How do we cope? This afternoon, we're going to take a look at anxiety. We'll talk about what happens in the brain when we're feeling anxious and about what we might do to manage this anxiety. Our guest this afternoon is psychologist Margaret Wuerenberg. She is the author most recently of the 10 best ever anxiety management techniques, understanding how your brain makes you anxious and what you can do to change it. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments this afternoon. We look forward to your phone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Margaret Wuerenberg is also the co-author of The Anxious Brain. Her latest book is The 10 Best Ever Anxiety Management Techniques. Both books are published by W.W. Norton. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Margaret Wuerenberg, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
I'm delighted to do it. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So how many of us suffer from time to time from anxiety, and how many of us find it more than a little uncomfortable, really a big problem?
Well, I think pretty much every human being from time to time experiences anxiety, because anxiety is the normal human reaction to situations that are ambiguous, where the outcome is uncertain. So we all suffer some of that, but over the course of our lifetime, 15 to 20% of us will have anxiety become a serious enough problem that we might want some help with it.
So how often might it be responsible for an effect on our health, our overall quality of life?
Well, this is what makes anxiety, when it goes too far, become a disorder, and that's what I'm thinking. 15 to 20% over the course of a lifetime, and what that really means is that anxiety can impair our health or our mental well-being in a variety of ways. For some people with strong social anxiety, it may cause them to stay out of circumstances where they could fulfill their potential, where children aren't learning social skills or staying out of situations in which they can develop the kinds of friendships, connections, and even developing their own talents they may not be doing that as much as they could for their own benefit. And over time, they suffer sort of social and vocational impairment. The kind of anxiety that starts to really affect our health is the kind that people often refer to when they say that they're stressed out, where they feel a physical tension, and that tension makes things worse. It makes migraines worse. It makes irritable bowel worse. It makes anything to do with muscle tension worse. You've got that. And then in terms of your immune system, if you're under stress for a long time and you're not managing it, it can become an anxiety problem. And that's really very debilitating even to your immune system. So you can run the range from simply how often are you getting sick to whether or not you're living a life that's really fulfilling to you.
Hmm. I would imagine it can often lead to problems sleeping, and then that might lead to exhaustion. So these things can have a snowball effect, yes?
Absolutely, and even circular, because the less sleep you get, the less able your brain is to release stress and discharge tension and help create the healthy neurochemical balance that you need to have a positive mood and an optimistic viewpoint. You need a healthy brain for a healthy mood. So the less you sleep, the more negative you get. The more negative you get, the harder it is to sleep. And I would call it very much a snowball effect.
Can it lead to depression? Can it lead to really serious health problems, like can it lead us down the road to, you know, being at risk for stroke or heart attack?
Well, I think like anything, I would hate to be alarmist about that, because people with anxiety immediately start to fear the worst in any possible situation.
Let's not make it any worse. Right.
But I will also say that if you're not taking care of your health, if you have a predisposition to a heart problem or a predisposition to another kind of physical problem, the stress isn't going to help it. Let's say that for sure.
Okay. But now there's good news, because we're learning some things about the brain, and there are ways that we can calm down and manage our anxiety. In the book, you say that our understanding of anxiety is changing. So what are neurobiologists and other brain scientists learning about anxiety and the brain?
Well, I think one of the things that's been very powerful for those of us who do mental health care to learn is that the more we learn about the way the brain functions, the more evident it is that mental health treatments, psychotherapy methods, actually help your brain to calm down and heal itself. And we learn more and more that lifestyle, which many psychologists and counselors focus very much on creating a healthier lifestyle with people, that those factors are powerful healing for a brain that's been either worn out from too much stress, and so your brain literally gets exhausted and it can't respond resiliently to life's problems. And so we can help restore the healthy brain function, and there are things that we can do that we can teach people to do that start from the first day you start practicing them to help you heal at a physical level as well as correct the emotional stressors that you feel.
Yeah, this was very interesting reading your book. Early in the book, you say, when something is not working efficiently in the brain, it affects how a person feels, thinks, and acts. All physical, mental, and behavioral anxiety symptoms can be controlled by techniques that use the brain to change the brain. So here we've got three categories or groups. We've got feels, thinks, and acts. And then we have this idea here. There's a lot going on in these two sentences. And then we have this idea that by using the brain in certain ways, by being conscious of what we're doing, we can actually change the brain.
Yes.
Okay.
And I can give you some examples of that if you'd like.
Sure.
I would invite you and any listeners to just take a deep breath and let it go. And then if you're in a position where you can raise an arm or two arms over your head and just give yourself a little stretch. And that might feel pretty good if you've been sitting for a while.
That does feel good.
What you just did is in the part of your brain where you think and make decisions. This is the part of the brain where we do what's called executive functioning. You made a decision, and you changed your respiration, took a deep breath, and let it go. But I would say, were you breathing before I suggested that you take a deep breath?
Of course.
Of course. And why? Because your brain automatically determines the amount of oxygen you need and automatically paces your breath. So when you start to get nervous or jittery, you start to breathe a little more rapidly. And when you have a panic attack, of course, you've got intense, rapid, shallow breathing, you can decide to change that, to take a deep breath. And we teach breathing techniques to stop panic attacks. So you literally take charge of your respiration. You take control of it by making a decision. You've used your brain to change your brain. When you do that, there's a cascade of things that happens that slows down your heart rate. And it slows down the output of stress chemicals. So you just have, by deciding to breathe, an entire cascade of physiological things that your brain controls. And you don't even have to know how that happens just to decide to breathe. That's one example of how your brain changes your brain. When I suggested that you raise your hands over your head, you did a behavior. Okay, pretty simple, a motor behavior. You stretched. But when you take charge of your behavior, you then start to change a lot of things in the way that you relate to the world. And one of the things that therapy talks about is very complicated behavior. Some of them as simple as asking yourself to do something that scares you a little bit, even though it's safe to do it. For example, some people with social anxiety would feel very frightened at this time of year when we're buying Christmas gifts and returning things. They might feel frightened even as much as going to a customer service counter and asking for a specific product or returning a product. And by preparing someone to do that and taking charge of their behavior, and then doing it safely, they're changing their brain so it will be less scared the next time they have to do that. So those are two fairly simple examples of use your brain to change your brain.
Yeah. And then over time, is there, getting back to this idea of snowballs and cascades and circles, these little changes that we can make or these little things that we can do add up?
They do indeed. If you have a tendency to be panicky, the more often you interrupt that by slowing your breath and do it effectively, and you may need some training to do that effectively, the more often you do that, the less often your brain is going to spontaneously start a panic attack. You're calming down your brain every time you interrupt it. Doesn't happen overnight, but it happens slowly over time, and it's very effective. And if you do things that might frighten you, and you manage to prepare for them, and then do them without fear, and succeed in doing them and feeling reasonably calm, your brain is going to be less afraid the next time. And the more often you successfully do a behavior that used to scare you and you do it a little more, like maybe when we're talking about kids perhaps who don't have some fear of going to school, get them to go to school and feel less afraid, and then the next day going to school is a little less scary, and the next day it's a little less scary until the feeling is that they can go into that academic setting without fear. We do this for people who have concerns about socializing or, as I suggested, these tiny little confrontations of life when you have to ask for something from another person. So these are the kinds of things. Your brain becomes less likely to generate the feeling of fear, and it makes it easier to do the next thing.
Can this be, these changes in the brain, can they be measured? Can we see them? What kind of work are scientists doing in what's the evidence for this?
Well, actually, you can see these on brain scans. You have to have a before and after, of course. People who are doing a lot of research in this field are looking at, there's a researcher named Jeff Schwartz who's been researching with obsessive-compulsive disorder, which is an anxiety disorder we won't be talking about probably much today because it's kind of complicated compared to some of these other changes. But he's watching changes in on brain scans, and he's looking now at the way mindfulness meditation changes the look at the brain. But he's only one among many. There are many scientists who are taking a look at before and after brain functioning. Daniel Amen, who does a kind of brain scanning called SPECT scanning, is taking a look at the way the brain changes with interventions that are psychotherapeutic and with medication. He's also a very big researcher in looking at the way your brain changes when you use drugs of abuse and has done some good work with that. Lots of different investigators, though. Pharmaceutical companies look at changes in the brain. And the difficulty with doing brain scanning is always understanding what was it that made the change in the brain. And so studies are complicated and hard to do to make sure it's that you know exactly what created the change. But we also diagnose by change in symptoms. I don't mean diagnose, I mean assess by change in symptoms. And we know that as people practice these methods, that their symptoms diminish considerably or go away altogether.
Getting to the idea of interventions, one of the things you say early in the book is that medication for anxiety is losing favor. Why?
I think that in our culture, we are so eager to have a quick fix. Americans are very aggressive in that way. And the thing is, it sounded like medications would just take away your symptoms. But they come with side effects, and people aren't so happy about the side effects of psychopharmacology. Now, I'll say I don't want to say that people shouldn't use medication, because there are many, many cases where it either makes therapy possible or really helps people that have severe difficulty to just start coping again. But they come with side effects, and some of the side effects are very unpleasant for people. The major category of medications that we use for depression and anxiety are the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. And the major side effects that people don't like with those are weight gain and loss of libido. And that has a big impact on quality of life. So if people can do therapy and get positive results without having to use the medication or getting off the medication sooner, many people prefer that.
Yeah. One of the things you do in Chapter 2 is you talk about medication, and you say that it can be very helpful, in particular if you're so agitated that you really need something to calm that intense feelings. In particular, you ask in this chapter, are you having panic attacks a few times a week or more? I can't imagine that. You know,
I'm glad you can't, because you'd be unhappy if you
Oh, my God. I mean, I guess maybe I can imagine it, but I haven't experienced that. So anyway, it can help. Medication can be very helpful in getting things down to a point where we could begin.
Absolutely. And there are medications that are, they're mood altering because they have an immediate anti-anxiety effect. The anti-anxiety medications in the category of benzodiazepine. These are often used very short term and hopefully with good supervision because of their potential to be addictive if they're used incorrectly. They're used correctly and at a therapeutic level, they're very safe, but you also have to look at a person's overall health. So when I say that, I think you really have to be talking to your medical doctor, your prescribing person, about whether these work for your health. But if you are very, very panicky, it's very difficult to even sort of get a hold of an idea that a therapist is telling you or helping you with, because panic just drives everything else out of your mind until you learn to start controlling it. But if you had only panic and no other mental health problem, it's actually the easiest of all the mental health disorders to get control of and eliminate.
Mm. Well, that's good news.
It is, but it's also one of the most debilitating because while you're panicking, you just can't do anything else.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is psychologist Margaret Wehrenberg. She is the author of the 10 Best Ever Anxiety Management Techniques, Understanding How Your Brain Makes You Anxious and What You Can Do to Change It. That's what we're talking about this afternoon. Anxiety, what happens in the brain when we're feeling anxious, and about what we might do to manage these feelings of anxiety. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener on line 4 in Eureka, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Could you repeat the author's name and book title?
Sure. It's Margaret Wehrenberg, and I'll spell it now for you.
Okay.
W-E-H-R-E-N-B-E-R-G.
Okay.
And it's the 10 Best Ever Anxiety Management Techniques. The publisher is Norton.
10 Best Anxiety Management Techniques?
10 Best Ever.
Best Ever. Oh, okay.
Okay.
Anxiety management techniques?
That's correct.
Okay. My two questions are, in the guest's opinion, have any studies showed any differences between singles and those not married or those not with a companion in terms of the amount of anxiety that they have?
Okay. That's a great question. Who's anxious and why?
Well, in terms of singles or marrieds, I think what it comes down to is the quality of your life. That the one thing that married people have as an advantage over singles is, except in cases where the marriage is absolutely the source of tremendous stress, okay, that most of the time people who are married have a sort of immediate support system. And a single person who is in need of support, let's say you get sick. You know, if you're married, then probably you have someone who will warm up the chicken soup for you or go get a prescription from the doctor or drive you to the doctor. Single person has to put a little more effort into that to make sure that they have contact with friends or be willing to call friends up and ask for help. That supportive piece that people don't always have when they're single. But I think in terms of the stressors of life, people have a little bit more pressure to take care of themselves. And I don't think, though, that the studies show they're necessarily more anxious than the rest of the population if the quality of their life is pretty good.
Okay. Does the listener want to follow up? Line 4 in Eureka?
Yes, just they have a better coping structure than single people do. Is that what you're saying? Because of the support building?
A support system, yeah.
Yep. Second question would be, you sound very much like people like David Burns and Aaron T. Beck in cognitive psychology, maybe Philip Seligman, when they try to get people to maybe talk back that their thoughts and thinking that their thought system may be the cause of their anxiety. Would you comment?
Yes. Well, I probably do sound like those very venerable and well-known writers, because cognitive behavioral therapy techniques are documented to be very powerful helps to defeat anxiety. The piece that I want to add to it that in Seligman's earlier research and Aaron Beck's earlier research, they didn't have the benefit of all of the brain scanning techniques that have become available, and in their later work, they certainly acknowledge that. So the cognitive techniques of talking back to your anxiety, if you will, and walking yourself through it are very powerful techniques. And is that what you were wanting me to comment on?
Just one more thing. Your book is titled The 10 Best
10 best ever.
Anxiety management techniques?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's take another call. A listener in Mattoon on line one. Hi.
Yes. Hello. I have a question for the guest today. I suffer from what I would classify as moderate to maybe sometimes higher than that, depression, anxiety, and those types of things. And often I think about, you know, psychotropic drugs or therapy or things like that, but I worry about the ripple effect, such as the stigma or life insurance in the future and things like that. Can you kind of communicate or tell us a little bit about that? I'm curious to know if I should be worried or shouldn't be worried.
Well, it's a little hard to answer without knowing what your diagnoses are and where they're located, but I will tell you that any mental health diagnosis is treated for insurance purposes in the same way that they might treat a physical diagnosis. They would look at what your diagnosis is and what the likelihood is of it having a long-term effect on your health. And so, for example, people who have been diagnosed with a major depression, that's a pretty serious diagnosis, and a life insurance company or healthcare company is going to consider that when they evaluate whether or not to issue a policy to you. But there again, it depends on how old you were, how long it lasted, what the prognosis was from your physician. There are many factors that would mitigate that. So I just want to say that you should carefully consider that if you're looking at especially, it wouldn't be as big of a deal if you were getting your insurance through a company you work for where it's a big group plan. But if you were independently paying for your own insurance, that would be something to think about.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Where are we today in terms of stigma?
In terms of social stigma, I think that it's, as far as I can tell, it's almost gone.
Yeah.
But the reality is that people with anxiety disorders visit their primary care doc significantly more than people who don't have anxiety. And so medical companies certainly look at that kind of a thing because it's real and measurable, that they're making a lot more health care visits, probably not because of their anxiety, though, but because of concern about other health issues. And that's the kind of thing that an insurance company weighs if they're going to give you a private policy. But in terms of social stigma, I think there's very little anxiety in the population. There's very little stigma about it because I think people are beginning to realize that these two conditions are very, very common among people they know.
Okay. I want to follow up on the Eureka callers. A question. Are some of us more susceptible to anxiety?
Oh, for sure, and for several reasons. One of them is obviously brain-based. You're born with the genetics that maybe you have a little less available serotonin just from the way your brain is given to you at birth. You know, you're born with fewer neurons that produce that very important neurochemical. And then if you experience a lot of stress, which puts a demand on that neurotransmitter, you can deplete your supply and be more vulnerable then to go into a depression or a state of anxiety as the result of that. Some of us are born with a brain structure that's a little more sensitive to the things that frighten us, so we feel more stress or we feel more fear than another person in the same circumstance might feel, which makes us more vulnerable to develop anxiety. And the other thing is the nurture. You can really model worrying to your children and model a negative way of thinking to your children and kind of teach them to worry if you're not careful about the way you express your own anxiety around them. So you can set kids up to look for the worst possible outcome instead of the best possible outcome, for example.
Yeah. I want to come back to children, but I also want to for our listeners, kind of give them some more specific ideas about what these 10 management techniques are and are all about. And they are grouped into to match symptoms. So
yeah.
we have a way of getting at physical symptoms to make us more comfortable, cognitive symptoms, that's how we're thinking, and then behavioral symptoms, how we're acting. So maybe here you'd give us an example of the techniques used to manage physical symptoms. And we did one of these earlier, the breathing thing.
Right. And the diaphragmatic breathing is a slightly more complicated than just take a deep breath. It's not complicated, but you have to learn how to find the pace and the manner and the stick-to-itiveness that will get you through a panic attack. But we also look at simple lifestyle things, the incredible vital importance of regular aerobic exercise, the vital importance of nutrition. You can't have a healthy brain if your diet has no nutrients. And nutrients, what I find, sometimes people don't understand the difference between nutrients and calories, that nutrients have to do with all the things that are in healthy foods, in our dark green leafy vegetables, and our good quality protein. An American diet very often has way too much of simple carbohydrates, like, you know, snack chips, potato chips, colas. Those have lots of calories, but they don't have anything that nourishes your brain. So you have to look at nutrition. We also tend to over-caffeinate ourselves through energy drinks and coffee and cola. And if you are already a tense person, you don't need more stimulation through those things. And then sleep. You know, if I could just say, if you had some anxiety and you started to eat right, exercise aerobically every day for half an hour to 45 minutes, and then you slept 8 hours a night, mm-hmm. you would be doing like the best thing that you could do to have a healthy brain. It would be, but that 8 hours of sleep, maybe for you 7.5, okay, but somewhere between 7.5 and 8, very important. So the physiology, and then in physiology, I look at also our intake of tension. Stress in our life eats up healthy brain chemistry, and we have to replenish it, and we have to take care of our physical health. So stress needs to be managed. That would be physiology. So I look at lifestyle management in terms of nutrition, exercise, sleep, and stress, and then breathing. Those are great physiological things. Then I want to look also at thinking, that you can take charge of worrying, all that, oh, what if this goes wrong, and what if that goes wrong, and oh no, any sentence that begins with the two words, oh no, you got to watch that, because that just even thinking that way makes your stress response kick up. And people are not always aware of what I call the inner dialogue. And if you can bring it to your attention how often you think about the worst outcome, or what if this goes wrong, or oh no, this could be bad, you can change the way you talk to yourself, and you can interrupt that ruminative over and over and over thinking that goes with worrying, and you can actually slow down the brain's tendency to ruminate by interrupting it all the time. So in terms of, I look at cognition, we're looking at stopping catastrophizing and interrupting worry or eliminating it. And in behavior, we're very much looking at two kinds of issues. The first issue is for the person who's doing too much. I call it TMA, mm-hmm. the too much activity person. And boy, our culture really starts this with childhood, to be go, 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 stimulate, 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 and no opportunity to just be peaceful. And that's very hard on the brain. And that person, I'm not saying we shouldn't be active, and there are many people who are go-getters, and that's fine, but to find the balance for you where you have some peace in your life, very important for a quiet brain, a healthy brain. And the other behavioral issue is for people who feel scared of certain things, whether it's a simple phobia like, oh, no, I don't like spiders, well, that's pretty easy to fix, but people who are fearful of any social circumstance where they might come to the attention of another person, a student answering a question in class, a teenager trying out for a sports team or a theater performance, an adult going to a job interview or business networking meeting or meeting a new group of people in their new neighborhood. Even, you know, trying to meet new colleagues at work or go to a church or something like that where people then behaviorally handle their fear by avoiding all those things. Avoidance works. You don't feel scared if you can successfully avoid it, but then you miss so much.
You want to get out of bed. Right?
There's
so much out there.
So that was kind of a long explanation. But
well, I thought you did a great job, and we'll recap really quickly at the end. But let's take some more calls, and let me reintroduce our guest. Our guest is psychologist Margaret Wernberg. She is the author of the 10 Best Ever Anxiety Management Techniques. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We go next to a listener in Farmer City on line one. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for the program today. It's very good. I would like to hear the doctor talk about anxiety that stems from experiences, both, you know, post-traumatic stress kinds of anxiety and just anxiety that may arise from bad experiences in the past. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks for the question.
Okay. You raise a very important series of questions, actually. If you have, and I'll sort of address it in a building way, sometimes people have a bad experience where they had a panic attack while they were driving, or they made an incredible, they were in a situation socially and they were incredibly humiliated, and they just never want to go back because they were teased or bullied or the humiliation was made worse by the way people handled it. That's a bad experience, and people never, ever want to repeat the panicky, fearful, awful feelings they might have. We can desensitize in therapy those experiences so that a person is willing to try again. But if you start to make that into like maybe a series of experiences, which happens very often to children who are socially awkward or are made the brunt of jokes for one reason or another by one or several cruel classmates, that can result in a lifetime of trying to avoid being in such painful social circumstances again. And that's traumatic for people. And so we have to deal with that kind of series of social traumas, and we can deal with those, but it takes a little bit of time because those are painful and traumatic. Sometimes people have very traumatic experiences from a medical illness or accident or being in a natural disaster. We use special therapy methods. By special, I mean therapy methods that really require the therapist to have specialized training to desensitize and take away the sting of those traumas. And that's a longer treatment than, for example, learning how to breathe to get rid of a panic attack. But every person with a trauma benefits enormously from learning to control the physical arousal of anxiety. So all of the things that I talk about handling physiology, breathing, cutting down on stimulation, finding opportunities for stress recovery periods of time, those are all really going to help people who feel traumatized. And then people who have serious trauma from a history of some type of abuse or history of combat experience or living with, so many of our young people who've been traumatically injured in combat in the last several years are going to have to make major life adjustments. They need, I think, a much more intensive and supportive therapy. So these 10 best ever techniques will be useful to them, but are only the very beginning of their therapy. They're going to need more intensive work.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line two. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
You know, if you think of what's the exact opposite of anxiety, or maybe not exact opposite, but something that can truly disarm it, and that seems to me that laughter and humor can play a vital role there. And I'll tell you, I'm reminded, I was watching an old Harry Potter thing last night, and Lord forbid that A.K. Rowling add, but in one scene, Rod Weasley, I think, had a terrible fear of spiders, and this monster comes out in a big, huge spider, and he's told to think of the spider on roller skates, and it was just hilarious.
Yes.
And but I think that's an unsung tool, I think, in solving anxiety. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more, and that's absolutely, that was the genius of J.K. Rowling in what she did in Harry Potter throughout, but she was able to take those life experiences and show corrections, and laughter is absolutely amazing for what it does for your spirits. And one of the features of laughter, too, is also there's a sociability about it most of the time. We're usually with other people when we're laughing, and so we have all of that social component that makes us feel connected and less alone. But laughter itself raises all kinds of, it raises your dopamine level. It makes your body feel good. Apparently, it's even really good for your abdominal muscles, so, you know, you get some exercise. There are even, it originated in India, but something called laughing clubs, where people get together and start the day with half an hour of belly laughing as a way to make themselves feel good and be stress resilient. Humor's terrific.
Hmm. I would imagine that also speaks to the place for art in our lives of all kinds.
That absolutely. And there's power in art and in music in particular. Music can pull you into a grieving situation and then lift you out of it just with the way the quality of the music goes. Music that soothes the soul. Music that's written in such a way as to promote the relaxation of the brain. We don't often, and sometimes music that lifts you up and energizes you and gets you going, you know, that makes you want to dance and move around. Music has a powerful impact. Art does a very similar thing. And story. To listen to stories about how people face adversity and recover from it are very, very powerful, which is why inspirational literature is good for people who are feeling anxious. To read books where people overcome adversity, or even read magazines that have true stories of inspiration, like the Guide Post magazines and stuff, those are wonderful tools for people.
It offers us a way, on the one hand, to identify with others and see commonalities, and then also there's that possibility for catharsis.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, before we run out of time, let's go back to children.
Yes.
What's anxiety like for them? And how can we stop and breathe with them and work with them on, you know, getting out of bed? Well, you might have a tummy ache, but, you know, when you know it's not the kid's not sick, how do you kind of gently get that little kid feeling better?
Yeah. You asked such an important question, because what we know is that when you have a child who feels their anxiety more intensely maybe than another child does, that may be the way their brain's made, but parents have such a preventive role in this. First of all, to model soothing behaviors. How do you soothe yourself and find things that a child does that makes the child feel better, other than simply avoid what they don't want to do, but things that are distracting and pleasurable and laughter-inducing. The other thing is that parents, if they are too permissive and say, well, honey, you just don't do it if you don't want to, oh, that's such a mistake. Because what happens then is the child learns that the parent doesn't believe in their capacities. And the child, with the parent who's very permissive in that way, that child learns that avoidance is what the parent thinks will work, too. So when you talk about, come on, honey, I know you don't feel good, but let's get out and do it anyway. I know you can do it, and here's how you're going to manage it. That's, I think, a demonstration of the right kind of encouragement. Kids need to be encouraged that they're strong, that they're resilient, that even if things go badly, they don't have to be bowed down and discouraged by it, that they can bounce back and recover from it. And I will say that with the exception of bullying, which is a dreadful issue to have to deal with the exception of that, kids can bounce back from little social bumps and bruises, and parents would be well advised to encourage their children to do that, because that's how we learn to survive in the world, to say, well, yeah, it was bad, but tomorrow will be better, and here's how I'm going to take charge if this bad thing ever happens again. This is what I'll do about it next time. So focus your children, if they have a bad experience, on, okay, it was bad, and next time if something like that happened, what would you do? Focus them on problem-solving.
Mm. Mm.
And if they survive a bad experience, really emphasize what they did well. Because we do more of what we rehearse in our minds. And people with bad experiences in general, whether children or adults, tend to revisit their mistakes and revisit their humiliation and revisit their fear. And you know what happens then is your brain goes, oh, now I know how to be afraid. But if you revisit the one or two little pieces that went really well and how you handled it and what you got through, your brain will say, oh, now I know some ways to get through that. So revisiting what worked right and encouraging coping skills, two very important things from parents to kids.
Okay. And let's recap the 10 techniques in terms of categories. Physical, breathe, eat well, move, sleep, and then you want to take cognitive?
Yeah. Don't catastrophize, as in, oh, no, get rid of that. Contain your worry and learn how to handle worries to interrupt your rumination over and over thinking right away.
Okay. And behavioral, I love this. Control TMA, too much activity, and we're heading into this time of year when it seems like TMA is just too much TMA.
Yeah.
So slow down, laugh, dance, sing, tell a story, listen to a story, and realize the spirit of the season, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, there we will leave it. I feel so much better.
Oh, good.
And I want to thank our guest this afternoon, psychologist Margaret Wuerenberg, and she is the author of The 10 Best Ever Anxiety Management Techniques. The book is published by Norton, and our guest's last name, Margaret's last name, is spelled W-E-H-R-E-N-B-E-R-G. Margaret, thank you again.
I thank you, Celeste. It was a pleasure.
It's 1:54 Central Time, and settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Kansas City Board of Trade. Here with those numbers, Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Let's start out in Chicago, where we always do, in the wheat pit. It was an ugly day in Chicago. A lot of red across the grains floor there. Wheat futures finished the nearby contract lower, down 33 cents at 467 and three quarters. The high was $5. The low at 467 for the Dees, and settlement for the soft red at 467 and three quarters, down 33 cents even. March contract 521 and three quarters, the high, the low at 485. Settlement price down on that low at 486 at 33 and three quarters lower. In the May futures, 530, the high, the low at 498. Settlement price at 499 and a half, down 33 and three quarters. July futures from the wheat pit, 547, the high, the low at $5.11. Settlement price at $5.12 and a quarter, down 34 cents. Kansas City wheat, 32 and a half lower at 497 today. The spring wheat settled at 572 and a quarter, down 15 and a half. Both of those contracts were the December. Back in Chicago, where the corn finished 13 and three quarters lower in the nearby December contract, with the high of 332 and three quarters, a low at 317 and a half. December corn, 318 and a quarter, 13 and three quarters lower. March futures, 349, the high, the low at 333 and a quarter. Settlement price at 334, down 14 and a quarter. In the May at 360 high, low at 344 and a half. Settled at 345, down 14 and a quarter. July contract, 370 on the high, the low at 353. July corn settled 355 and a quarter, down 14 and a half cents. In December for next year, 395, the high, the low at 378 and three quarters. Red December settled 379 and a quarter, down 15 cents. December oat futures, 203 the high, Low at $2.50. Settlement price, actually, the low can't be that because the settlement price was $1.98.50, and that's lower. Down 7 cents till today for the December oats. March contract, $2.21. The high, the low at $2.12.50 there. Settlement price at $2.13.50 for the March oats, 7.50 lower. From the soy complex, January beans, $8.34. The high, the low at $8.08. Settlement price at $8.11, 19 cents lower. March contract, $8.38. The high, the low at $8.11.50. A settlement price, $8.15.50, down 19.50. May futures, $8.45. The high, the low at $8.19.50. Settlement price at $8.23.75, down 19.25. And July soybean futures, $8.53.25. The high, the low at $8.28.25. Settlement price, $8.33, down 18.25. December bean meal futures, $2.49.30. The high, the low at $2.44.80. A settlement price at $2.47.30, down 70 cents. January bean meal at $2.45.50 on its settlement, down 120. December bean oil, $30.30. The high, the low at $29.10. Settlement price, $29.22, down 106. And the January futures at $29.50. A settlement there, down 108. I'll return in just about 9 minutes. During the closing market report today, we'll talk with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group in Decatur, Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson in Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Another lower day today for the livestock contracts. December live cattle, the high today 84.10, the low 82.75, the settlement 83.07.5, that down 75. February 84.40, the high 82.75, the low 83.07.5, the settlement, that down $1. April 86.30, the high 84.95, the low 85.12.5, the settlement, that down 92.5. June 82.35, the high 81.10, the low, the settlement 81.45, that down 65. January feeder cattle, 89 even, the high 87.25, the low 88.10, the settlement, that down 25. March 88.55, the high 86.30, the low 86.90, the settlement, that down 115. April 89.50, the high 87.60, the low 88.35, the settlement, that down 90. May feeder cattle, 90.40, the high 88.30, the low 89.50, the settlement, that down 90. December lean hogs, 57.55, the high 56.95, the low, the settlement 57.10, that down 47.5. February, 64.30, the high 63.17.5, the low 63.65, the settlement, that down 72.5. April, 70.45, the high 69.50, the low 69.85, the settlement, that down 102.5. May, 78.15, the high 77.10, the low, the settlement 77.20, down 205. And February pork bellies, 92.50, the high 90.60, the low 91.10, the settlement, that down 90. The Dow is off 62 at 85.29, the NASDAQ down 16 at 14.76, the S&P 500 off 9 points at 8.61. The contract for the nearby month of crude in New York down 249 at 44.30. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Mike Solo's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: north, increasing cloudiness with occasional flurries developing. Elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny with widely scattered flurries, mainly in north central Illinois. Highs ranging from 21 in northwestern Illinois to 37 in the far south. Tonight, north, cloudy with scattered snow showers and flurries. In central sections, partly to mostly cloudy with scattered flurries. And in the south tonight, partly cloudy. Lows ranging from 2 in northwestern Illinois to 22 in the far south. Tomorrow in northern